All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be the host today. I'm really fortunate to do that. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam, had the privilege and honor of flying above the best in 1969. So I want to welcome you to our program today. We've got a couple of interesting things that I hope that you're going to be excited by. Number one is we're going to be talking with a doctor about a kidney condition, actually, that has been affecting many more veterans than I certainly anticipated. Over 500,000 veterans are suffering from kidney disease. And so we're going to talk about a new arrangement with the American Kidney Fund and the VA to talk about how they're going to be doing that. And after a quick break, we're going to come back with our expert foreign policy guru, always a great guest on Veterans Radio, and that's Dr. Rebecca Grant, and she'll be on to answer our questions and your questions if you want to get involved. The number here at the station is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Before I get to my guest and before I get to my little announcements, I do want to make sure that I want to thank our faithful sponsors, and they include the Legal Help for Veterans, the National Veterans Business Development Council, the Eisenhower Center, VetBiz Central, and VBA Post number 310, American Legion Post 46, and the VFW Post 423. All those are from Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you want to learn more about these organizations and their services they provide, just go to our website, veteransradio.net/our sponsors. I also want to mention that many of you may not be aware that Veterans Radio is now, a production of Veterans Radio America, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And we just started collecting or accepting, I guess you could say, donations, and we've been very fortunate. We had our first match from a corporation, so I'm really excited about that. If you'd like to help out Veterans Radio, please just go to veteransradio.net and click on Donate. Buddy money, that's what we're calling it. And we could always use your support. So thank you very much for that. I've got a couple of announcements, as I mentioned earlier on, and I wanted to talk about. Number one, and these are our annual events that are happening right now. Number one is the Wreaths Across America. And so we really encourage you to go to their website. That's wreathsacrossamerica.org. And join them in their National Wreaths Across America Day. That's December 19th this year. And each December on National Wreaths Across America Day, their mission is to remember, honor, and teach. It's carried out by coordinating wreath-laying ceremonies at Arlington National Cemetery, as well as more than 1,600 additional locations across the country, all 50 states at sea and abroad. So I encourage you from Veterans Radio, we want you to sponsor these folks. You may want to get involved. You may want to sponsor a veterans wreath at a cemetery near you. Just go to their website, Wreaths Across America, and you can help out. Number two, of course, is the Marines. Always the Marines are coming through again with their Toys for Tots annual toy drive this year. They want to make sure, you know, it's kind of an unusual situation out there. And so, I'm encouraging you to join with this organization of Toys for Tots. Help out these children that are less fortunate than many of us are. For more information, you can go to toysfortots.org and either make a donation or volunteer your time to help out with the Marines League that sponsors Toys for Tots. And remember, it's only a month till Christmas. So get out there, and you can go to the Toys for Tots website. That's easy for me to say. Toys for Tots website. And you can find the locations where you can drop off unwrapped toys this year. So please, please, please go do that if you can. Finally, this is a little bit more local, and this is a virtual Veterans Summit that's coming up on Friday, December 4th from noon until 3 p.m. This is going to be at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, and it's I encourage you to sign up for this. It's for businesses and veterans that are looking for employment. They've got all kinds of speakers coming in. Let's see, they've got guest appearances by Detroit Police Chief James Craig. They've got, Sergeant Ramon Rogers, United States Marine Corps. They've got the Navy League. They've got Who's Who in Black America, Black Detroit Emerging Leader. Couple of lawyers, everything for veteran-owned business certification specialists from our sponsor, NVBDC. For more information and to register for this, please just go to EbenezerVeterans@gmail.com. That's EbenezerVeterans@gmail.com. And they're going to ask you to include your name, phone, and organization. Again, this is a virtual Veterans Summit on Friday, December 4th from 12 to 3. We're going to have more information about this next week here on Veterans Radio. Their logo slogan this year is Empowerment for Life and Business Success for the Future. All right. I want to remind you again, any of you out there that have an organization or an upcoming event that you would like us to promote for you, please send me an email. That's dale@veteransradio.net. And we'll do everything we can to get your announcement on the air or on our Facebook page. You can follow us there, of course, Facebook. That's Veterans Radio. And we want to help spread the word. You guys are doing great jobs out there, and we want to be able to help you help people out if you can. All right, we're going to go right into our first interview right now. And I got an email this week that I a little shocking to me, and I'll just read it real quick. It says, about 500,000 veterans have kidney disease, and that number has continued to rise 6% each year over the past 5 years. I thought this was astronomical. I just couldn't imagine those numbers. So we reached out, and we have a guest on our program today. His name is Michael Spigler, and he is the Vice President of Patient Services and Kidney Disease Education for the American Kidney Fund. And Michael, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having us, Dale, and thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. I was shocked by this. I thought that number was really high. I mean, I realize that there are approximately 20 million veterans in America, but that number just, ooh, right in my eyes. I mean, I've had kidney stones starting at 28. And so I said, oh, I'm not alone here. So tell me about this arrangement of between the American Kidney Fund and the VA.
Sure. Well, just to your point, I mean, yes, there are lots of vets that are dealing with this, but there are a lot of Americans just in general. There are 37 million Americans with some level of kidney disease in the country right now. And unfortunately, as few as 1 in 10 actually know they have it. Kidney disease usually doesn't have any symptoms until it's pretty far along. And unless you're getting the test and you're asking the right questions about it, you may not know that you have it. And really, that kind of key point is one of the reasons why we wanted to move into this partnership agreement with the VA to not only raise awareness about kidney disease in general, but also start to offer some resources for those 500,000 that you talked about that already have it.
So why is that number so high? I mean, is it something that we've been exposed to, or is it our habits, our daily eating habits, drinking habits, whatever it might be?
You know, it's hard to tell why it's a little bit higher. I can tell you the two main causes of kidney failure in kidney disease is high blood pressure and diabetes. Diabetes causes about half the cases, and high blood pressure causes about one out of every four cases. Now, there are some instances where, yes, if you're exposed to toxins and things like that, that can affect your kidneys. It's rather rare, although we do have an ambassador for us that was a vet and was near some toxic chemicals and was exposed and did lose her kidneys. Our kidney function to that, but that's rather rare. It's usually diabetes and high blood pressure is by far and away the cause. And, you know, as you get older, kidney disease starts to develop. Unfortunately, just like everything else, your body starts to age too. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of you folks are really, you know, physically fit, right? Maybe living longer just in general. So these things are starting to trickle in too, could be a part of it also.
Okay, so we're talking with Michael Spigler here. He's the Vice President of Patient Services and Kidney Disease Education for the American Kidney Fund, which is partnering up with the Veterans Administration to raise awareness of kidney disease for veterans. Approximately 500,000 or half a million veterans have chronic kidney disease. what should we do? If what are some of the signs that we should be looking for?
That's a great question. So again, there's usually hardly any symptoms or signs of kidney disease until it's pretty far along. If you ever did feel something where, you know, you're not urinating as much as you were before, or much more than you were before, or you have pain in your lower back, you know, in areas that you know, on kind of the side of your lower back, that could be a sign of it. If you see any changes in your urine, if there's blood in your urine, things like that, those could all be a sign. But really, you can't rely on that. And people relying on that is one of the reasons why as many as one in three people actually will be called crash into dialysis. So in other words, they go to the emergency room thinking, oh, I have the flu, or I'm not feeling well, and they're told their kidneys have failed already, completely failed, and have to start dialysis immediately. So the most important thing I can recommend to everyone out there, A, to prevent it, is to make sure if you have high blood pressure and diabetes, you keep those under control. If you can keep those under control, you're eliminating about three-quarters of your risk, because three out of every four cases, again, are caused by those two things. And most people are getting the test for kidney disease when they go to the doctor. The two main tests are a urine test for protein in your urine. It's called a UACR. And most people will get that as part of an annual physical that they do. Or a blood test looking for GFR, which is, it's a mouthful. It just means how fast your kidneys are really filtering your blood. Those two tests in combination will find kidney disease. It will find it early. The urine test will find early kidney disease. The GFR test will find it anywhere from, there's five stages of kidney disease, so anywhere from, you know, stage three to five, it'll find it there too. But if you're having those two tests, and especially if you have high blood pressure and you have diabetes, next time you go to the doctor, just say, hey, doc, how are my kidneys doing? And get them to answer that for you directly.
Well, I know a lot of the medications that people my age are starting to take all have warnings about kidneys, you know. In the literature. And so does kidney disease affect more men than women, or is it about even?
It is about even. It does, unfortunately, affect African-Americans and Hispanics at a higher rate than Caucasians. But the spread on men and women are, you know, not much of a difference there.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And so you guys have set up this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, and to your point about meds, it's important. If you have kidney disease already, it's been identified, there are some medications that can affect your kidneys and make your kidney disease worse. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, pain meds can affect that. There are some arthritis meds that can affect it. So it's definitely worthwhile to have a conversation with your doctor if you have kidney disease about the meds you're taking. That was a very good point that you made.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just know so many people that, you're not supposed to take certain pain relievers, and, you know, some of the medications that we are taking do affect our kidneys anyway, and that's one of the first things that many of the doctors do check, when we have our annual checkup with them. And unfortunately, it seems like there's a lot more, especially the high blood pressure, and as you mentioned, the diabetes. Is it type 1 or type 2, or does it make any difference?
Well, there's just more people in the country with type 2, so that's usually I would say there's probably more type 2 causes, but either one can do it. And, some people, like my mom's a good example, you know, she had type 2 diabetes so badly, she actually developed type 1 as well. So it's really just diabetes in general.
Okay. Well, there are two things that I wanted you to point out to our audience, which I thought was interesting. And number one was the American Kidney Fund's financial assistance program. Could you go through that quickly?
Absolutely. So we've assisted about 3,300 vets just this year with financial assistance. We help with anything from health insurance premiums to safety net grants, which are just like a $100 grant. You know, when you're at the end of your rope and you just need to pay for a medication copay or put gas in your car, to help with those kinds of things. We offer disaster relief as well. So we've helped with the wildfires this year, all the hurricanes. And then a bit of a twist on the disaster relief program that is, unfortunately, new this year, is our coronavirus emergency fund. And we've actually helped a little over 500 patients, vets this year already with that. That's a grant, a $250 grant, just meant to kind of give you a hand up when you've been economically affected by this or physically affected by it. The vast majority of people that have used that grant have used it just to buy groceries. You know, this pandemic has taken a toll not only physically on the country, but as you know, economically too, and people are struggling with both things. So, if you're interested in that, it's available for kidney patients that are on dialysis or they've gotten a transplant, and they can apply on our website, which is kidneyfund.org. They can find information on how to apply there.
Okay, I think that's really that's terrific. There are so many organizations out there that are doing as much as they possibly can to help the American population through this whole pandemic thing. So if you're running into an emergency, you have kidney problems, here's an organization to go that might be able to help you out. It's kidneyfund.org. The VA is out there. It's those of you that get your medical care at the VA, they have specialty care, as many of us know. They have nephrologists there that specialize in that. They provide dialysis. They have telehealth where they can answer your questions. They also, it says that they perform only over 150 kidney transplants annually. And they do a lot. They do a lot of research. I can't tell our audience enough about the research that the VA is doing, not only to help veterans, but it ends up helping the entire general population with the research that they're doing out there. So
you're so right.
I'm gonna give you 10 more seconds, Michael, with your that you can do. Give us a plug. What do we need to know?
Yeah, so learn more about everything you need to find out about your kidney disease, what's at risk, and the programs we offer. Again, our website, American Kidney Fund, is kidneyfund.org.
Okay, thank you very much. It's Michael Spigler, Vice President of Patient Services and Kidney Disease Education for the American Kidney Fund, talking about their new partnership with the VA. So thank you very much, Michael, and please keep us informed of any changes or updates that we need to know about.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you very much. All right. That's make sure you check that out, folks. That's the AmericanKidneyFund.org, and you can maybe find some information that will help you. I'm sorry. It's Kidney Fund, just Kidney Fund. All right. We're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to have our foreign affairs expert extraordinaire, frequent guest on Veterans Radio and one of our favorite people, Dr. Rebecca Grant. So don't go away. We will be right back.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org. Or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
All right, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and I always play that Air Force theme when our next guest is ready to appear, because she has flown in T-38s, E-3s, AWACS, B-52s, F-16 aggressors, F-15, and the B-2 Spirit bomber. She is also the founder of Iris Independent Research, which what their mission is military facts, strategic analysis, advanced technology trends, air power, pretty much everything. And Dr. Rebecca Grant is our guest. She is a national security analyst based in Washington. She's written over 100 articles for Air Force Magazine and has appeared regularly on the Smithsonian Channel, Fox News, CNN, and Veterans Radio. So, Dr. Grant, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hello, Dale. It was wonderful to hear the Air Force song, Atta Boys, Give Them the Gun. Ready to talk
there
to you.
There you go. I knew you would like that. So how are things with you and everything in Washington?
And everything in Washington. Well, we are in a very interesting time, waiting a little bit to see what some of the first moves might be from presumptive President-elect Biden. And, of course, watching around the world to see the reaction. And, you know, one thing, Dale, that really strikes me is how much has changed over the past 4 years with Team Trump in office. He perhaps to some people's surprise, turned out to be quite interested in world politics. He turned out to be a pretty energetic and relatively agile diplomat, and he made a score of major, major changes to U.S. defense and military and foreign policy. And so if the Biden team takes over in January, they're going to find a very, very different landscape, and it'll be interesting to see whether they will capitalize on that or go back to some of the older policies from when Joe Biden was vice president under Barack Obama.
I am curious about that as well, and I think we all are. You know, is he going to be his own president, or is he going to bring a, you know, bring forward a lot of the things that they were attempting to do, you know, 4 years ago? So I guess a couple of things that you had mentioned, you know, when you said here are some things that we want to talk about. Number one would be climate change, because it is part of foreign policy.
And here's one that was not really a factor in the foreign policy discussions of 2016. Really, frankly, it wasn't even that big around the time of the 2018 midterms. But now, climate change is one of Team Biden's top international priorities. And I'd love to just take a minute, because I've had to catch up and see why this has moved so front and center. I'll tell you also that over in Britain, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson just came out a few days ago with his own ambitious climate change plan. Boris Johnson's a Tory, a conservative, and so interesting to see him working on this as well. So, you know, what surprised me at first and may surprise some of our listeners here is that, there's been a long simmering debate about climate and the changes in climate. My view on that is, hey, I've looked at history. I can see that the climate changes. You know, the Vikings could sail the Atlantic 1,000 years ago when it was calmer. We know that Shakespeare wrote about the mini ice age in Britain. So the climate changes. But now this climate change has been linked directly to an agenda for international reforms. The top goal is trying to control the overall rise in global temperature prior to the year 2100. Yes, that's 80 years off. But the immediate linkage now is saying, hey, Team Biden says we want to take immediate steps to work on this goal and to put a lot of money behind it. So one of the first things that Biden said after the elections was that on day one, on January 20th, he will put the United States back into the Paris Climate Accords. Do you remember what those are, Dale?
Right, yes.
Right.
A number of countries that were trying to work out a solution on their own, yes.
Exactly, and it's done under the auspices of the UN. There are about 200 signatories. President Trump pulled the U.S. out in 2017. Here's what's interesting about the Paris Accords. Their goal is to try to get individual nations to control their carbon output. So, and here's the big problem, okay? Of course, won't surprise you, the big problem is China. So China has come out and said, sure, yeah, we'll do this carbon control thing. We'll control all our carbon emissions and get to net zero by the year, 2060. Right? So the rest of the world, including Biden, is looking at more like 2030, 2035, very ambitious goals. So part of Biden's platform is to spend about $1.7 trillion to achieve this net zero emissions result. And this happens through a slew of new technologies and investments in everything from carbon capture to more solar panels, on and on and on. A lot of it is, you know, there's a very worthwhile goal here, but the international politics angle is really tough. Because China is basically saying to the world, okay, you go first, you know.
Right. And speaking of China.
Go ahead. And, you know, you won't be surprised either to learn that the biggest carbon emitter on planet Earth is the People's Republic of China. So they account for about 28% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. is about 14%. The European Union around 10%. And, you know, perhaps even more, you know, problematic here is that China's carbon emissions have gone up. So they have gone up from the period of about 1990 to 2017. China's carbon emissions went up 353%. 353%. That's because
what did ours do?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because U.S. emissions in that same time period, 1990 to 2017, they went up a little, they went down a little, but the net change, 0.4%. So basically flat. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
China up 353%, U.S. 0.4%. Okay.
You do the math right. A little aside on that is India is part of that. Is it just because of so many people?
It's a bunch of things. It's numbers of people, of course, with China. It's the industrialization and the development that has been made possible in part by Western cash and trade. But what it is it leaves. You know, India is also a big emitter, and so in order to make any real difference, especially in greenhouse gas emissions, you know, it doesn't. You know, planet. We could do all the carbon capture in the world, in the U.S. and in Europe, and China can ruin the atmosphere all by themselves, you know, because once it gets produced, up it goes. So it's really a tough thing, and I think, you know, the bottom line for me is you've got to be able to have agreements with China, and what we've seen, and maybe we'll talk about later, is China's not doing well at respecting their international agreements. Look at Hong Kong. So it's really an interesting stretch to say, climate's now our number one priority, and yet we know the one nation that we really need to get into line is not going to do it. So, interesting change there. But the momentum is very much behind seeing a lot of climate activity. You know, the other thing too is it sort of strikes me as bad tactics, right? So, in a way, the Team Trump is handing Team Biden, you know, kind of a good field position because they've pulled out of Paris. And how hard would it be for President-elect Biden to say, hey, I might want to rejoin the Paris Climate Accords, but here's my list of conditions, China. So, you know, it's just to run right back to it without saying, hey, let's negotiate, let's try to get China to do something meaningful. It tells me that Team Biden has a ways to go to square climate change objectives with realistic foreign policy tactics.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what is going to happen whenever that does happen. And, you know, whatever our expectations might be, I mean, who knows? You just never know what's going to happen when everything starts over. But he does have a big task to look at because the START nuclear arms deal expires in February, which is only, you know, 11 days or so after he takes office. So let's talk about the START program.
Right, the START program, and that is the one of the many acronyms, I tell you, the acronyms that you find around arms control, or it would just fill page after page. But this is an agreement that has puts limits on strategic arms. You know, Dale, we have so many fewer nuclear warheads than in the 1960s or the 1970s. The arsenals have come down a long, long, long way. Really, really small numbers. Now, we know Russia maintains a pretty big stockpile of what they call non-strategic nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons. But this agreement concerns the strategic arms limitations, and it affects our nuclear submarines. It affects the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles or ICBMs up in the missile fields, and it affects the number of nuclear-capable bombers that the U.S. and the Russians have. This treaty is just a bilateral treaty. It's between Russia and the United States. And it has a clause to renew it for another 5 years. But as you said, on February 5th, that runs out. And so there's been a lot of quiet back and forth between Russia and the United States about whether they will go ahead and renew this treaty. And I think, in general, there's a great desire to do that. Now, we've seen some interesting behavior from Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, who has happily displayed a lot of new systems, his hypersonic boost glide systems, a replacement for one of his ICBM systems. he has been kind of waving around these strategic weapons or research programs for quite a while. But there's a sense in Washington that he's been doing that partly because actually he does want to renew New START. He'd really like to keep that agreement in place. I think the Biden administration certainly wants to renew, but they won't have a lot of time to get in there and go ahead and do that. And then a question has arisen as well. China has modernized its nuclear weapons to a great degree, and would China be willing to join in this? Well, of course, the Chinese have said absolutely not. Under no conditions would we ever agree to any nuclear arms control agreements, which is just, you know, that's so them. Okay, we think they'll agree on carbon, but they won't agree on nukes, which would be easy for them, right?
So yeah, anyway, I think so.
Yeah, and I think we may get a sign. Simone Sanders, who is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris's press spokesman, has said that we should hear some cabinet picks on Tuesday, so in 2 days. And there's a sense that one of the most likely would be Secretary of Defense, and a leading contender for that is Michelle Flournoy, who served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration. Was actually offered a job by Team Trump, but turned it down, and she's seen as a leading contender. If she comes in, very good, because she's very strong on the military services and military force structure. And she, or in fact, I think, any Biden pick at defense will be in favor of renewing New START. Of course, that will also fall to the State Department to get the deal done, and we'll have to wait and see who he may have in mind for Secretary of State.
It's going to be interesting, that's for sure. I hope he doesn't just, you know, we don't necessarily want him to just recycle everybody from before.
Yes, and, you know, it's sort of, I think, in a way, a bit of a temptation because it's, you know, it's only been, you know, the 4 years, and so most of the people that served either on Vice President Biden's national security team or in other positions in the Obama administration are still still have very fresh knowledge and fresh credentials. So I think there is a temptation to do that. They've been pretty quiet about what they're thinking. One thing they have said is that they do want a range of diversity in the cabinet. There also are rumors that Senator Chris Coons from Delaware is interested in the Secretary of State job. Another person mentioned is Susan Rice, though she had was sort of never formally nominated under the Obama years because the senators that she met with didn't think that they could support her nomination. So we'll see what comes from that. Biden also, you know, in selecting his chief of staff, picked someone who has been very close to him, truly a Biden person, with Ron Klain, rather than someone who was just in the Obama administration. So he may pick people that he's comfortable with. That would be certainly to be expected.
Yeah, you certainly would expect that. Let's go away from China for a little while and move on over toward Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got troop reductions underway. What is going on with that? For our audience's sake, we are talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant here about American foreign policy today and maybe into the future. So what do we think about Iraq and Afghanistan reductions?
Right. This was a big announcement from about 10 days ago when President Trump, who has talked about this for many, many months, said he would actually start some troop drawdowns. So let's start with Iraq. The number of troops coming out of Iraq is estimated to be about 500. The troops that we have in Iraq now are doing two missions. One is the ongoing support of Iraq's armed forces in the sort of low-level but still ongoing battle against the remnants of ISIS. So the ISIS caliphate has been stamped out, but there remains a level of activity much lower than in the past, but there are still U.S. forces supporting there. The other role for U.S. and international forces is a broader training relationship training Iraq's forces. And in fact, I think Canada is currently running that mission, and we see some formal involvement from NATO. So we're taking 500 forces out of Iraq. That is, you know, sort of a necessary rotation, rebalancing. I don't think it really changes anything in the military relationship between Iraq and the U.S. and in the multinational task force that's assisting Iraqi security. Okay, almost business as usual. Afghanistan is a bit of another matter because, let me back up for a minute and remind everyone that there is an Afghan peace deal. There is a formal deal signed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo with the Taliban. This was a deal that was brokered by our U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, who is, you might guess from his name, is a native of Afghanistan. He's long been an American citizen and has been our U.N. ambassador and also our ambassador to Iraq and to Afghanistan. Now he's a special envoy, and he brokered this deal, which was signed in February. It's a deal. It's the only deal we've had. It's not the best deal in the world. It's not the strongest deal. But so far, the parties are complying. And there was a particularly important step that happened this fall when what they call intra-Afghan talks began. And that is formal talks between Taliban representatives and the government of Afghanistan. Now, Dale, you're probably like me, and I just saying the word Taliban makes me cringe. Yeah,
yes.
You're talking to the Taliban makes me cringe. But Afghanistan's government, duly elected government, has said, look, we have got to try to work with these people. And so we have signed a deal. So this is the background to President Trump's decision now to take about 2,500 U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. And to remind, again, we still have a multinational and NATO-backed effort in Afghanistan. I think 84 countries are part of this coalition in Afghanistan. The two other reasons he can withdraw troops, one is he increased the troop levels there a couple years ago, so he's taking some of that down. The second bigger reason is that our strategy all along across multiple administrations has been to build up Afghanistan's own army and their air force so that they can handle some of their own security better. And comes a point when that handoff has to be made. What is staying is quite a bit of U.S. and allied command and control, air power, special forces, and the ability to go back in pretty quickly if need be. But the drawdown of 2,500 forces coming out is part of this overall effort that I think we all want to see, which is to bring the war in Afghanistan to a close.
Absolutely. It would be nice. I mean, that's, 20 years is more than enough to do something like that. We need to take a real quick break, Dr. Grant, so I want you to hold on, please. Reminding our audience that if you do have a question, you can call us at 734-822-1600. We're going to be playing our Medal of Honor segment this week, and we've started a new program here at Veterans Radio where you can sponsor the Veterans Radio, the Medal of Honor segment. And so this week's Medal of Honor segment is brought to you by Kate Melcher. Kate is the Fisher House, Michigan Executive Director in honor of her Army Aviation brethren, past, present, and future, who fly above the best. We'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Major Bruce Crandall made 14 flights into the Valley of Death, evacuating wounded. Details after this. Crandall made several routine flights into the Itrang Valley in November of 1965, transporting a battalion of troops. Suddenly, the ground troops came under a massive attack from the NVA. On Crandall's next flight, three soldiers on board were killed and three wounded, but he remained in the line of fire so four wounded men could be loaded on his chopper. Crandall, along with Captain Ed Freeman, continued to make supply runs into the battle zone and airlift wounded out. During the course of the day, he flew three different choppers, with two of them so badly damaged they could no longer fly. At the end of the day, it evacuated 70 wounded men and brought in supplies which helped the battalion to survive. Freeman was awarded the Medal of Honor in July of 2001. President Bush awarded the Medal of Honor to Crandall on February 26, 2007.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio. Hey, I'm Willie Nelson.
Thousands of veterans are living on our streets right now where they're being robbed, beaten, and even killed. And if this happened behind enemy lines, we'd be outraged. So please help us get our veterans into safe, permanent housing. Donate any amount at veteransmatter.org. Or you can text VETS to 41444. They fought for us, and now we fight for them. Veterans Matter.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant about all things foreign policy, all things military here in America. We've taken a look at China. We've taken a look at Iran, Iraq and Afghanistan, and points east and west. I wanted to talk about a little bit about the Space Force. I haven't heard much about that recently. What can you tell us about the Space Force?
There's a lot of news about the Space Force, which is just a month away from its first birthday. The United States Space Force was created on December 20th of 2019, and Dale, it's the sixth branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. It is a legit service all of its own. It's small right now, but it has a four-star commander, General Jay Raymond, who, of course, came up through the Air Force and is now commander of U.S. Space Force. They picked a motto back in the summertime, and it's really nice. I don't know if you speak Latin. I don't. But
no.
The motto for the Space Force is Sempre Supra.
And always what?
Always above.
Oh, okay.
It's a lovely motto. I mean, that means, of course, that they, and they say they picked it because that means that they are always above and protecting, and that they always want to be above any threats and to guard that domain. So it's just a lovely, lovely motto, and I think it symbolizes the really very quick and elegant stand-up of the Space Force. If you had asked me 3 or 4 years ago if we would have had a Space Force, I would have said, nope, never going to happen. But I tell you, there were a couple people in Congress who really wanted it, and then I think we have to give credit to Vice President Mike Pence, who came into office and said, oh my gosh, we've got to do this. The reason, of course, is the just unbelievably increasing threats to space from China and from Russia. China has ground-based laser weapons that can target our satellites. And as you know, really, we now are totally dependent on satellite systems for our daily life. And we're starting to put more things of value in space. So the Space Force is there to organize and defend all of that. And, you know, they've done a good job. They are also coming up on a very important and politically fraught decision, and that is where to put their headquarters. So you might think Peterson Air Force Base in the Springs, Colorado Springs, which was the home of Air Force Space Command, would be the natural choice. But there are other contenders, and last year they made a really smart decision, and that was to put it off for a year until after the elections. Anyway, they are looking at a couple of different places that some of your listeners may recognize, Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico. They're looking potentially at Offutt in Nebraska, which is home to Strategic Command. Of course, there's Patrick Air Force Base in Florida, which is the great launch range, and Peterson in Colorado. Of course, there's another important base in Colorado, which is Schriever Air Force Base that does a lot of satellite control. And then apparently they're also considering Redstone Army Airfield down in Alabama and possibly even Port San Antonio in Texas. So there's some different candidates there as well for Space Force headquarters.
Well, that should be interesting to follow. It sounds so exciting. It sounds so futuristic, of course. And which is what is happening in our world today. Everything moves along so quickly that, you know, if you blink, there's going to be something new out there that we weren't aware of in the past. Let's move on to Taiwan. We talked about China with the climate change, and they're involved in so many different things, and they're threatening Taiwan again, it seems like. And so what do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, Taiwan is a time bomb. Taiwan is at the top of China's list. As we recall, Taiwan is the last holdout of what was once the Chinese nationalist forces. And when Mao and the Chinese communists won the revolution in 1949, they chased Chiang Kai-shek and his army back to the island of what we now call Taiwan. Over the years, Taiwan has become a liberal democracy and a very strong economy. They're the world's 20th largest economy. But the Chinese communists, now led by the Communist Party, now led by Xi Jinping, president of China, they have never, never given up on saying that Taiwan should belong to the mainland. So it's ebbed and flowed, Dale, as you know. There have been times when we've really worried about Taiwan, times that we haven't. But this year, Taiwan has gotten much, much, much more aggressive. They have violated Taiwanese airspace quite a bit. They have sailed some ships close by and made pretty much weekly, sometimes daily, threatening rhetorical statements. And, you know, their point is that Taiwan is supposed to be part of China, one China. What the issue is for the U.S. is that Taiwan is what we call a treaty ally, one of our five in the Pacific. So we do have a treaty to defend Taiwan. Now, here again, the Trump administration has taken some pretty aggressive actions. They have started some defensive arms sales to Taiwan. In the past, these would always get held up. So Taiwan has military equipment, but some of it's quite dated. The Trump administration has new F-16 sales and also some new missile sales underway. These are all defensive. And from a strategic point of view, we're really getting to the point, and people in Washington recognize this, where I think it's really time for the U.S. to underline its willingness to defend Taiwan in order to deter China before they decide to get too bold. And China's actions around Hong Kong over the past year and a half have really, I think, sharpened the problem and made the stakes in Taiwan more important. And here's, I think, where we will see a recognition of this also from Team Biden. One of their advisors said that, you know, Taiwan, we've really got to resist Chinese pressure against Taiwan.
Well, it's not only a pressure there. As you mentioned, Hong Kong has come under a lot of pressure. And you also mentioned India as well.
Oh, my goodness.
I thought that was kind of interesting. I hadn't thought of India.
The situation with India is just so bizarre. You know, back over the summer, there were 20 Indian forces killed on the border with China. And now there are all these odd stories circulating about, were there high-power microwave weapons that were used? You know, the one thing we do know is that there were 20 Indian soldiers killed. And remember, there have been border conflicts between China and India in the past. But you put it all together, whether it's Taiwan, whether it's, of course, the ongoing activities in the South China Seas, Hong Kong, India, and what you see is a more militarily aggressive China. And so that raises the stakes for the U.S. and for our allies in the region. We really need to link arms shoulder to shoulder and show that we're willing to deter China in the military sense. You know, of course, China is a big trade partner for everyone, and the trade war is a whole other conversation. But alongside that, we have this military balance. And it's up to the U.S. and to our key allies, Australia among them, Japan, of course, South Korea, to continue to show that there's no chink in the armor that China can exploit. We really need to hold that military balance in the Pacific.
It sounds like we definitely need a united front going on there, because we still haven't even gotten into North Korea. What's going on there? I don't even know if the guy's still there.
I know, North Korea, right? And back in the spring, there were rumors that there was a week or two we thought he might be ill or possibly have COVID or something like that. Well, apparently he's still there. Absolutely, he's still there. We know this because back when President Trump had his COVID diagnosis, Kim Jong-un sent warm regards during that period of time. Okay, more broadly, what's going on with North Korea? I think China has sort of told North Korea to cool it, sit down, be quiet, and let's see how the broader U.S.-China confrontation works out. But I think it's a good moment to just look back and kind of recap what we've seen. We have seen a number of changes over the past 4 years. Of course, 2017, the Trump administration came into office with President Obama saying to President Trump, hey, North Korea is your biggest problem. Well, yeah, because North Korea had exploded 4 or 5 atom bombs and done 50 missile tests while the Obama administration was in office. We had that tense summer of 2017, and then what resulted from that, after more missile tests and another nuclear test, was an agreement by Kim Jong-un not to test any more long-range missiles. And he hasn't. He has held to that agreement. Yes, there have been some little plunk it here, plunk it there, smaller shots, but no long-range missile tests. And this is really good because he is thought to be at least a dozen tests away from truly developing a reliable capability to do warhead reentry on an ICBM trajectory. So the lack of testing, if that's all that they get out of that 4 years of diplomacy and summits and all that, that will be worth it. I think the other thing, too, is if when you talk to the military commanders, one really good thing that's come of these past 4 years is that the communication levels between Washington and Pyongyang are much better. You know, back in 2017, President Trump said he wanted to talk to Kim Jong-un. They weren't like totally sure how to make that happen, right? But now that has been established. Obviously, disappointments on the lack of progress in denuclearization, but the stability in the region is better. Relations between North and South Korea were doing really well for a while. Now they've chilled as well, and there have been some border incidents. I don't think we're going to see much resolution with North Korea until the larger U.S.-China problem is solved. And in fact, China, which commemorated the anniversary of the Korean War, this was the 70th anniversary of their invasion in November of 1950, right? So, and oh my gosh, they made, earlier 1950, they made a huge deal of when China intervened in the Korean War, or as they call it, the war against U.S. aggression in Korea. So that kind of just tells you where all that stands at the moment. So I think, on the whole, although, you know, North Korea did parade a missile in the fall, and it's an ICBM, but it's a liquid-fueled two-stage, and I would rather see the dumb missile going down the street in Pyongyang than going up across a test range.
That's true.
The lack of long-range testing has been a real positive outcome. The rest, I think, is just going to have to wait on some movement in U.S.-China relations.
Okay. Well, coming up on the end of the hour, again, how fast these things go, Dr. Grant, I wanted to give you a minute or so to talk about your Air Force Historical Foundation.
Oh, terrific. Yes, I'm on the executive board of the Air Force Historical Foundation, which was actually set up by the first chief of staff of the Air Force, Tui Spots. The Air Force has a 75th anniversary coming up in 2022, and the foundation is putting together a book, and we're calling it 75 Great Airmen. So we'll have little biographical sketches of people from Jimmy Doolittle to, probably General J. Raymond, the first chief of the U.S. Space Force. But I want to invite your listeners to send us some nominations. We'd like to hear from you if you have a favorite airman, you think someone who is a great airman, you know, a Chuck Yeager or someone in that category, and you can send those nominations to us. We have a special email to Foundation. We're going to give it to you now. It's 75 great, that's 75 great, at afhistory.org. 75 great at afhistory.org. So nominate your favorite airmen who have served on active duty from September 1947 onwards. And what we already have on our list is the 18 airmen who were awarded the Medal of Honor in that time period, ranging from 1947 up through Tech Sergeant Chapman, who was awarded for actions in Afghanistan. So please send us your ideas on 75 great airmen, 75 great at afhistory.org.
Okay. There we go. Please keep us informed. We would love to do stories about these famous airmen just as much as you are. I've only got a minute to go, so Dr. Rebecca Grant, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio again, and we will be in touch, and I can't wait to talk to you in the new year.
Thank you, Dale. Enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. All right, so we've come to the end of another hour here, folks. Next week is our benefits program, so make sure if you have questions about the VA healthcare or the VA benefits program that you send me an email. The other thing, I would be very remiss if I didn't remember that this is November 22nd. On November 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, and for many of us that were around at that time, it's a memory that sticks in our mind forever and ever. So take a second to remember those days if you were here. For the rest of you out there, we want to thank you very much for listening. This is Dale Thronberry on Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.